Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
A career that reflects the values of many KALW listeners is social worker. But what's it really like to be a social worker? To address that question, my guest this morning on Work with Marty Nemko is Jessica Ritter. She is, after 20 years as a social worker in the trenches, she ran Pacific University's social work program and is now associate dean and author of the book, now in its second edition, 101 Social Work Careers. Jessica Ritter, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Well, thank you very much, Marty. I'm so happy to be with you to talk about one of my favorite things to talk about, which is social work.
What's another thing you're interested in talking about other than social work?
Oh, you mean just in normal life?
Yeah.
You know, dogs and politics are probably rank right up there.
Dogs? tell me, we'll get serious, I promise, but tell me one, so I'm assuming you have a dog.
I do. I have a little Shih Tzu named Addie, short for Adeline.
Yeah, we are very similar because I have a little white little muffin who's a kind of a half poodle and half terrier. He's a schnoodle. Tell me one thing that might surprise you. No, how did you find him? How did you pick your doggie?
Well, you know, I had lost a dog, and many of us who are dog lovers know how tough
that is
when you lose
yes.
a dog. So I was in the midst of that, and, you know, went on the search for a new dog. You know, some people wait years and years. That same very week, I found a family with a litter of puppies and fell in love with this little dog and brought her home. So
we are very compatible. I have done exactly that, and now I'll get good. Serious. I mean, I'll get serious at least. Okay, let's start with basics. How did you get into social work?
Yeah, well, you know, like a lot of undergraduate students, I don't think I was any different, that I was kind of floundering around, to be honest, and I couldn't quite figure out what my major should be. And I knew if you would have asked me then, you know, what are you interested in, I would have said, well, I know I want to help people in some way, but I was also really interested in large social problems like poverty and inequality. Mm-hmm. So I did an internship with a state legislator at the time. I was living in Texas in Austin. And, you know, I was really into politics at the time. But I learned before he became a lawyer and got into politics, he started telling me his backstory, which is that he had a master's degree in social work, and he was a community organizer. And he started telling me these great stories of how he, you know, worked with very poor Mexican-Americans on the border of Texas and Mexico. And it was one of those light bulb moments in life, to be honest, where I just was like, oh, this is what I'd been searching for. I never really knew social work existed. I never knew a social worker. So I very quickly changed my major to social work and got my undergraduate in it, worked in the field for a number of years, got a master's in social work, worked in the field, and then ultimately I did end up getting my doctorate in social work. So it's been kind of a life, I guess a labor of love ever since.
It's really wonderful to hear this because I always try to picture my listeners as we're talking, and what you describe may be the quintessential, to use a statistical term, the modal, the most frequent story that I hear from callers on this show and to the clients in my private practice. They always felt they want to make a difference. They want to they care about people. They were political activists. They care about income inequality. It's like you are my prototypical listener and client.
I love it.
Okay. So, you know, I'm a fan of myths, and your book identifies a bunch of myths about social work. For example, that you need to be a psychologist to be a therapist or counselor. Why is that wrong?
Yeah, it is. So, you know, a lot of students come to college and they're interested in they'll say, I want to do counseling, I want to do therapy. You know, they see themselves working with children a lot of times in a therapeutic context. And for some reason, the only discipline they've really been, you know, told much about is psychology. And so they come thinking, I need to get a psychology degree. And most people don't know, actually, that the majority of mental health practitioners in this country are social workers. They have a master's degree in social work. They end up getting their clinical license. Now, there are a number of paths to get there, and you certainly can go psychology route. There are some counseling programs. But I'm probably a little bit biased, but I would argue that the most marketable and common degree to do this would be to get a master's degree in social work, actually.
And what does that enable you to do and not to? I'm sure that the psychology lobby makes sure that they don't want anybody encroaching upon their turf. what are licensed social work, clinical social workers allowed to do relative to what a, quote, psychotherapist is allowed to do?
Right. Well, after you get your master's degree in social work, you have to get your clinical license, which takes many, many hours of working under a licensed clinical social worker. You have to pass a licensing exam. But really, it enables you to do the same thing as a psychologist in the sense that you can have a private practice. You can hang a shingle up and do what we would call, you know, clinical therapy with individuals, with families, with children. So really, it's the same thing. You know, the nice thing about going the social work route is a master's degree is much shorter than getting a doctorate in psychology, because usually that's the terminal degree in psychology is you would need to get the doctorate.
Are you in a position to assess the validity of the following statement? My guess would be that someone who wanted to do counseling with a social work background are people where the nature of the client problem is going to be more interdisciplinary. It's going to be more the family, the school, the health problem, the political system, economics, etc. Whereas perhaps a psychotherapist is going to be more individual related. Is it going to be will the work be more multidisciplinary?
Yes, I would say that, you know, one of the hallmarks of social work education, what we train, you know, and educate people to do when they get a social work degree, I would call it sort of, it's very holistic. So when someone comes into your office with a problem, you're not only going to sort of look at them in the vacuum of having them in your office and in that narrow problem that they're coming to you with. You're really trained to think about the larger social environment around them and all of the various things that are impacting that problem. So I think that would be a big difference.
Okay.
And then the other thing, just to say, you know, what I would say is the biggest misconception about social work, and I think we would have a lot more students, you know, coming into the field and majoring in social work if they knew this, is that they have this very narrow conception of what a social worker does. And they think that the only thing a social worker does is come in and take kids out of their home, you know, because they kind of identify it so much with child protection work.
Sure, right.
And what they don't understand is that, and this is the reason why my colleague and I wrote this book, 101 Careers in Social Work, is that we wanted them to see that there are literally, you know, hundreds of different work settings you could be working in as a social worker.
Right, and that's what we're going to try to explore, at least, you know,
yeah,
a good sampling of those. But let's start with what is certainly a common, which is the caseworker, and you described it as, quote, very stressful. And you actually were yourself a caseworker whose job was this was after kids were taken out of their homes. This was to reunify families when the kids been removed because of, say, child abuse. You described it as very stressful, but you learned a lot. What'd you learn?
Yeah, you know, this is one that ranks up high on the stress scale. What I would say is there's also another misconception that all social work is very stressful, and I don't think that's true. There are actually some social work careers that don't rank super high on the stress scale, but certainly child protection work does. I think you're working in a very adversarial court system when you do that work, and you're, you know, seeing children who have experienced maltreatment, which is very stressful. You know, I think you learn self-care as a social worker because you expend so much energy and emotional energy of yourself. You really have to learn to take care of yourself. But what I learned, probably the biggest lesson of doing child protection work, was that I thought I was going to go in and learn all about child abuse and neglect. And what I learned is that the reason child abuse and neglect is happening in people's lives really stems from poverty a lot of times, from mental illness that parents have, and substance abuse. So really you come out of it saying, oh, what I really developed expertise in is learning about poverty and how hard that is for families and mental illness and substance abuse.
I'm surprised to hear you say that the courts, that it's very contentious. Give me an example of the, you know, not the anomalous, you know, outlier, but the typical kind of contention that might occur in a child protective services hearing in a courtroom.
Right. So when you work in the child welfare system, you're working in the civil court system, not the criminal system.
Okay.
But parents will have attorneys appointed to them because their rights have been sort of taken away from them as a parent temporarily.
Mm.
The children has an attorney appointed to them, and then you as a caseworker actually have an attorney representing the state. So you go to these court hearings, and it's adversarial. I mean, people are sort of yelling, and, you know, they're, you know. So, you know, what I always tell people is I love doing that work, and it's such important work, and I would never take it back. But you have to sort of get used to going to work every day and have people yell at you.
So what's
you know,
the yelling?
You have parents, you know, who aren't happy that you're in their life. You have attorneys calling and yelling at you. So you just have to get used to that.
Can you paint a picture? Can you actually, I don't know, this may be too much to ask of you. Could you role play the kind of thing that, you know, the kind of contentious yelling that might, you don't have to yell, but what would one say, and what would the other say, and what would the other say, so we can get a feel for the nature of the powerful arguments on both sides.
Right. I mean, I think that most of the contentious arguments that would happen in my experience were oftentimes with parents where, you know, there was pretty clear evidence that abuse and neglect had happened. So I'm thinking about sexual abuse cases, for example, where a boyfriend of a mom had sexually abused her children, and it was pretty clear that she knew that that was happening and didn't adequately protect her children. And so you're working with her, and you really want to help her get her children back, but one of the things that has to happen is that she has to come, you know, sort of admit and say, yeah, you know, this happened, and I'm willing to sort of get help and try to figure out how to get better so I can, my kids can come back to me. But when you're in the office with someone and they're just saying, you know, no, you know, I don't want you in my life, this didn't happen, and they're just, they kind of stay in that really, that place of denial, which makes it really difficult.
Okay. And I'm assuming you mean didn't adequately protect her. They knew what was going on and kind of just turned away, didn't say, you must stop it, get out of this house kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. You often describe, and I'm going to get off the casework thing because I know we want to talk about those less stressful and other kinds of interesting social work, but I want to just, because it is so common, I want to take one more shot. You describe the job of social work, casework, as crisis-driven, outside the courtroom. Give me an example of the kind of crisis, again, not an anomaly, but the kind of crisis that a social worker, caseworker, would encounter.
Yes. So all social workers get trained in crisis intervention. And there's a new kind of big catchphrase these days where a lot of social work programs are teaching students what we call trauma-informed care. And that's because so many of the individuals and families that we work with have experienced trauma in some way. So, you know, what you have to get really good at and comfortable with as a social worker, I'll just give you a few examples of a crisis. So you have people where the floor has kind of fallen out beneath them and their life feels like, you know, everything is very out of control, and you have to sort of come in and work with people when that's happening. So for me, that was when kids were removed from a home, that was a crisis.
When you say out of control, be specific. When you say the floor has fallen out of them, what does that mean?
Yeah, it just means that some event has happened in their life and they're in a state of grief. They're in a state of feeling that their life is very out of control. They don't know what to do. And they need someone to come in and give them some support and some guidance and some resources and knowledge to help them through that. You know, for example, you know, sometimes you're working with a family, they've just lost their home or they just lost their job. That's a state of crisis. You might have a client who's just experienced a sexual assault. That's extremely traumatic. You might have a parent that you're working with, and all of a sudden they have a child that they love very much who's experiencing really severe mental health problems.
Mm-hmm.
The list could go on and on.
You talk about what we normally commonly think. We think of the social workers working at the multigenerational poor that have a whole, it's not like suddenly one event, but it's like it's the cumulative effect of poor education, poor parenting, poor peer influences, drugs, shootings, culture that doesn't value hard work. How often is the problem really a sudden something versus the constellation of things that lead to the multigenerational poor?
That's so smart of you. I love that you said that. So that's why social work is so great, because we're trained to work with people with their individual problems, but really even more important than that, we're trained to understand, you know, how these social problems affect people or things in their community. So when you talk about trauma, think about living in a neighborhood that's very poor and doesn't have the resources it needs, and there's a lot of violence in that community, and children are attending schools that are very substandard. You know, that's a level of trauma that people are experiencing that certainly is contributing to their problem. So a good social worker wouldn't come into a neighborhood like that and say, I'm going to give everybody therapy. They would say, we need to work at a larger level here in terms of working with policymakers and community leaders to figure out how do we improve this community and bring resources to the table so that people can really thrive?
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. I'm talking with Jessica Ritter, the senior author of the book 101 Careers in Social Work. And now, as promised, we're going to leave that the most, you know, that super stressful component, one of the 101 versions of social work. And let's talk about what you described as a more upbeat one, which is adoption social work. For example, I found it interesting there's an increase in so-called open adoption. Why don't you explain what that is and how it affects a social worker's role?
Yeah, you know, I think the big takeaway here is that one of the things you have to do when you're a social worker is keep up with the latest research in your field. You know, sometimes we look back on practices that we used in the past, for example, in mental health, and we say, oh my God, I can't believe we used to use electric shock therapy very commonly, you know, with everyone who had a mental health problem. And, you know, we gain new knowledge all the time, and especially through research. And this is true in the adoption field. You know, in the old days, when someone would adopt a child, there would be no contact with the biological parents or the biological family. There was this very rigid separation there. And then over the years, there were these really smart researchers, some of them social work researchers or others, who realized that it would be more beneficial to have what we would call openness in adoption, where once a child is adopted into a new home, there would be some level of contact between the biological parents or the biological family over the years. And that can really vary in terms of what that openness looks like. Mm-hmm. So it's a very interesting area for a social worker to work in terms of the adoption field.
Makes a lot of sense. And at the other age, of the other end of the age spectrum, social workers obviously work with older adults. You have an anecdote about that?
Yeah, well, what I would say is that, you know, one of the things that we're really trying to talk to students about today who are going into social work is that, you know, we're experiencing the graying of America right now.
Yep.
You know, we have the baby boomers retiring. So this is really an area that if students are smart, they would think about making sure that they sort of practice with older adults. I think that's where the field is going to be going in a pretty big way. So there are social workers I know who work in the field of adult protective services, for example.
Mm, where elder abuse.
Elder
yeah.
abuse. You know, mm-hmm. we talk so much about child abuse, but we don't really talk
sure.
about elder abuse, so that's a big field. And then the other one I would say is really big is hospice and end-of-life care.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
right.
We're seeing a lot of states that are starting to pass more legislation allowing physician-assisted suicide, for example.
Right.
But social workers can be pretty instrumental in helping people figure out how do I want to have a good death and how can mm-hmm. I die with a lot of dignity and things like that.
Sounds great and really important. As you may know, California just passed a Death with Dignity Act, which I think is very, I love
yeah.
giving people choices from pro-choice whether they're going to have an abortion, to pro-choice whether they're going to be LGBTQ or when they want to end their life. They have the state has no role in helping in those very intimate personal decisions.
Yes,
so,
I agree.
Okay, so what, you know, the elder abuse, you know, my mom was 90, and I swear I did nothing abusive, but I could certainly see how it gets difficult at the end. Do you want to paint a picture of not where some monster abuses or a burned out worker in an assisted living facility, but we hear stories of how normal people mm-hmm. can abuse passively or through neglect their elder parent. Have you ever, do you know, can you give an example of that kind of thing, or am I delusional about that?
No, I think that's true. So I think that the couple forms of it that are most common would be what you're talking about, which is recognizing that caregivers do experience some degree of frustration at times
mm-hmm.
when you're caring for older adults. So certainly they could take out that frustration in a physical way. I would say, though, that the most common form of exploitation when it comes to older adults actually is financial exploitation.
Mm.
So this would be, you know, you have, you know, the children caring for their older parent and, you know, taking the money and taking the Social Security money and using it for themselves. So I don't work in that field, but when I've talked to people who work in that field, that's the thing that they're really focusing on these days is financial exploitation.
And if I were your brother and I was thinking of going into a social work career and I was unclear whether I wanted to work with children or elders,
mm-hmm.
what would you say are some the core pros and cons I should be considering?
Of trying to decide between the
yep.
two?
Yeah.
You know, I would say the great thing about going through a social work program is the coursework requires you to have many experiences mm-hmm. in the field as you're learning. So you're kind of learning in the classroom, going out into the field. So I would say, you know, do both. In other words, you know, go and do an internship at mm-hmm. Adult Protective Services, for example, but then, you know, do an internship working with at-risk youth, for example. And I think that students, when they sort of get in there and they have the experiences, they find that they'll have the passion, you know, one way or the other.
Let me tell you what my guess would be, and you tell me if this at least comports with what your intuition says. I would think I'd want to work with kids if I wanted to have at least the hope. It may not be the reality because of the large multigenerational poor, but the hope that if I save a kid from a horrible environment or help the parent to do a better job of parenting, he or she has a whole lifetime to flower.
Yes.
If I'm dealing with an older person, I might, on the other hand, if I feel like, you know, I feel like I can manage this. If I can make sure their pain management is taken care of, mm-hmm. and they're getting the care they need, and it feels like it may be a less. There may be people who have a smaller constellation of problems, ironically, when you were seeing, so you feel you're actually more visibly making a difference. Is there any legitimacy to that hypothesis?
Well, yes. And, you know, one of the challenges we have in social work education is that almost all the students I have actually will tell you, when you say, well, what do you want to do and who do you want to work with? I'm telling you, the majority of the time, they want to work with kids and mm-hmm, youth. And
right.
I think it's for that reason. They kind of feel like, I want to impact a child's life in a way that's going to be very meaningful and impactful. And so we have a challenge in getting them to be more interested in thinking about working with older adults.
Mm-hmm.
I think also so many of us fear aging ourselves.
Right, absolutely.
So you have to sort of, if you work with older adults, you're kind of facing your own, you know, mortality.
And the pain and the scary dying process. And
right.
I have great, I don't know the word, I guess admiration, or at least I'm grateful. Grateful is the right word. I'm grateful for the hospice workers who are willing to deal with people at these, you know, very not nice times. And
yes.
Because we are forced to face our mortality. Okay, let's get away from either end of the spectrum.
Uh-huh.
Let's focus on substance abuse. There, you wrote in your book, 101 Careers in Social Work, that there are a number of social workers who specifically specialize in addictions and substance abuse. Tell me something that might surprise me about
yes.
working in that field.
I do think there's actually something really interesting about this field that's not true of all the other social work fields, and it's very interesting. So most social workers or others, there are other professionals that will work in that field that have different professional backgrounds, but one thing that sets it apart is that many people who end up doing that actually experience the problem themselves.
Mm.
And so it's really common that they had an addiction or you know, a problem themselves, they got recovered, they went into recovery,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and then they decide, I want to really help others. I'm
mm-hmm.
going to get my social work degree
mm-hmm.
or some other kind of license so that I can go in and help people. I honestly don't feel like I would be as effective in that field because that's not an issue that I've had myself.
Exactly. I'd feel the same way. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
There's a different process. They're finding that genetically different people have a different predisposition to addictions, to alcohol, to others.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have it, you can't begin to understand the depth and the complexity of what's going on in those people's heads. And I really do think that the ex-addict, in the same way as I think that the best math teacher mm-hmm. is not the genius at math. It's somebody who mm-hmm. struggled his or her way to an A. That
yeah.
person is going to be in a much better position to help the kind of students who really need math help. You buy that?
I do agree with that. And what's interesting is in social work, sometimes if you have a criminal background, you know, if you committed a crime in your background,
yep.
that can be a hindrance in coming into the field. But
right.
I will say this is one field where they actually give you a little more leeway because
uh-huh.
many people who had addictions do have a criminal background. But if they can show that they've gotten their life together and they're very stable and doing well, then usually that's not going to be a deal breaker.
I love
field.
It. And that, of
so.
Course, would generalize to being a parole officer. I understand it's one of the things in your book is that social workers sometimes are parole officers, and I would think that somebody who is an ex-offender mm-hmm. who is reasonable, you know, even if he or she's not a saint, if that person is nonetheless relatively, you know, every candidate for every job has got pluses and minuses.
Mm-hmm.
So even if an ex-felon, say, is not a saint, I'm not saying they're going to go and kill the client, but they may not be perfect, but that's a huge plus in my judgment. Somebody who even has a lot of experience as an ex-offender might make the best parole officer. You buy that?
I would agree with that. I will say, though, that that's going to be a difficult thing to do. In other words, if you want to do social work in the criminal justice system, and there's lots of different possibilities there,
mm-hmm.
I will say that's a system that's not as forgiving in that way, so
mm-hmm.
that would be a tough thing. In other words, if you had a criminal background and you wanted to do that, it probably would be a really tough area to
Got
go
it.
Into.
So
yeah.
you would steer me more to addiction than such. So let's
yeah.
look at the other side. We're now talking about former offenders. What about, I mean, you know, I have a lot of sympathy, obviously, for the victim. You
mm-hmm.
mentioned rape or murder or assault or whatever it is. What, and I read in your book, again, the social workers do work with victims. Tell me
yeah.
a little bit about that.
So I think criminal justice is a really great area for a social worker to go into. And like you said, there's so many options. So you might be drawn to working with offenders, which is really important, especially there's a lot of what we call these reentry programs.
Yep.
When people come out of prison, you help them sort of get their life back on track. But then on the other side of the spectrum are people who say, I don't know if really working with offenders is my thing, but I really feel for victims of crime. So people who've experienced domestic violence or experienced sexual assault or even just, you know, any kind of really serious crime, I want to be their advocate and help them go through the court system and support them. So there are these really great victim services programs in the country that you'll find social workers working in as well.
Sounds great. By the way, I just got a book, and I haven't read it all yet, but I'm intrigued by it. It's called From Jail to Jobs by a guy named Mark Drevno. It's a topic that, despite doing this show for 26 years, I've not addressed. So, first of all, I recommend at least take a look at the book. Don't buy it because I haven't read it yet, but go to Amazon and look, read what they say about the reviews. I think it got some great reviews called From Jail to Jobs, and I'm hoping if the book is as good as I think it is, I'll have him on the show, and we'll talk about that topic. Then there's forensics.
Mm-hmm.
They may testify in court on who should get custody, as you were implying earlier. Mm-hmm. They might, and I'm surprised to hear this, but in your book you say they might evaluate a defendant's mental competency. I thought that would be what, PhD psychiatrists. First of all, is that true? I mean, would a social worker without a PhD be likely to be called in to evaluate a defendant's mental competency?
Yeah, so forensic social worker is this new kind of sexy thing these days where I think people usually think CSI or something.
Right.
So what it really means for a social worker, though, is, and these don't have to be PhD people, these can be master's degree social workers, but what they're really good at, what forensics really is helping gather information, gather a really good history, and making an assessment to a court about what should really happen with a defendant, making recommendations and those kind of things. So forensic social work is really big right now, and then also mediation is another growing field. Mm. Social workers are really good at helping people mediate legal disputes so that they can avoid having to go to trial.
Great example. I always thought it was judges and lawyers, but I could see a good experienced social worker be a good mediator. You also, one of the other sub niches within forensic social work, you call mitigation specialist. That's the what you wrote surprised me. You wrote that it always seemed like the social worker was there to try to reduce the penalty on the biological mom. Is that an incorrect assertion? That was the implication I got from reading your section on that.
Yeah, I think more so, mitigation specialist in the sense that sometimes, social workers are really good at understanding people's backgrounds and what led them to become involved with the criminal justice system, and trying to get a court to see sometimes that they should have a more lenient ruling because someone, maybe was in a very abusive home or was really set up in a lot of ways to fail in their life. So a lot of times it's sort of coming in and being a proponent of saying, yes, this person committed a crime and they did something, but we really think in terms of sentencing that you should try to think very carefully and thoughtfully about what the sentence should be.
Is that an example of what, we all come to the world with different biases, and the public tends to have a view that the social worker is going to always, opt for the leniency. But, if you look at all the stakeholders, if you act like a utilitarian who's trying to consider all the impacts, we know the recidivism rate is very high, for example. So putting a kid who's been abused back in the home, net are you really doing good by trying to mitigate the sentence?
Well, yes, these are very, I will say that this is the great thing about social work is that there's often not black or white situations. They're very gray, and we have a lot of ethical questions that come up. So the biggest thing that I think we do to, as social work educators is try to have social workers who go out into the world who can really grapple with some of these tough questions. A lot of times there's just not an easy answer.
It isn't. You live in the world of gray.
Right.
Yep. Well, one of the things that I know, we've been talking kind of at the micro level, what individual social workers do, but you have both in your book and, every sense I have about you, I read, Googling you and the like, you've got a particular interest in social workers being activists for policy change. You mentioned at the beginning of the show, thinking big picture. How likely, another one of like the prototypical clients are called the show, they want to make policy. Everybody wants to make policy. What is the likelihood that Jane Doe goes to social work school and she says, I think I'd like to, make policy. What is the likelihood that she will actually end up making significant policy, even at the local level?
I would like it to be much more than it is, so I'll be really honest there. One of the biggest misconceptions that people don't know about social work is that the mission of social work is actually social justice. And there's this huge macro dimension to our work. But everyone, if you talk to people in the public, all they really know about us is that we work with people in a very individual way. They really only know about the micro-level work. The best anecdote I'll give you is Frances Perkins. My favorite famous social worker is Frances Perkins. And many people have never heard of her, and it's really unfortunate. But she was the Secretary of Labor for FDR. and she was the first woman to hold a cabinet position, and there's great biographies out there of her. But what she did is she was really the sole driver and architect of the Social Security Act. The reason we have the Social Security Act passed in the law is because of her, and she was a social worker. She believed that we should have a social, you know, security program, that we should have unemployment insurance, that we should have a public welfare system for very poor Americans, that we should have a minimum wage. So those are the kind of things that we're trying to do in schools of social work, is to equip students to not only do the micro-level work, but to also be able to be effective agents in the political arena.
You know, one of the things that is a core belief of mine, and it's so visceral, it really is, it's foundational to me, is that there is wisdom across the political spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And while certainly, especially the majority, the large majority of listeners to the show and to the station would agree with every word you say, mm-hmm. there often are arguments that there is a downside, for example, to the welfare state. And I'm wondering if you look honestly in your heart of hearts, mm-hmm. because your job is not just to train people, but to create thinkers, people who are thoughtful, full-dimensional thinkers in the full marketplace of ideas. In your heart of hearts, do you think social work training does a good enough job of not making straw man arguments for the downsides of some of the, you know, cradle-to-grave social programs, but real substantive arguments, because it's not just idiots, you know, right-wing Trumpniks who are advocating it, but there's some very thoughtful people who have deep concerns about a cradle-to-grave social program. Do you believe that in your social work programs you give fair-minded attention to the full range of responsibly held ideas?
Okay, so that's a good question. So I certainly think that we could be, so if you look at social workers as a profession, do we need to be much more powerful and be out there and be a much stronger force in the way that sometimes I think about teachers or nurses, that they're well organized and they really, you know, can go out there and try to affect change politically. I think social workers, we're trying to do that. I think we have a long way to go. So, you know, but I think that we do equip them to understand how important it is that we have very strong social programs, you know, as a social safety net.
Yeah, I don't think you answered my question. You know, my question was, I understand that. You want them to be more activist, you want them to be more powerful, you want them to have more social programs. But as my point, maybe I wasn't being clear,
uh-huh.
is that there are really arguments that can say that taking more taxpayer dollars to provide that social program has significant negative consequences, not only to the taxpayer, but even to the recipients, and that there are at least responsibly held arguments that should be made so that you don't have just ideologues graduating who are kind of just going forth with their worldview, but in full understanding of another worldview that is at least worthy of careful consideration. So my question to you is, do you think social work education does enough to educate people fairly about the full range of responsibly held ideas?
Right. So I think one thing you might be getting at is social work neutral in that way in terms of their views? And I would say, honestly, it's really not. It has a value base and a mission of social justice. So it's not going to embrace very conservative ideology in that way. You know, we would be much more embracing of a Scandinavian social welfare model. So most social workers would actually argue that the social welfare system we have in place does not go far enough, we would be much stronger as a nation if we embraced more of the Scandinavian model.
Yeah, there are different opinions. Everybody is in favor of social justice, but there are many definitions that I'm only hearing a very valuable and important one set of those definitions of how to get to social justice, and I'm a little concerned that it doesn't reflect the full range of things. But we've now beaten that dead horse. What would be one particular policy, since you like being activist, big, make a difference, change society, social justice in your way, what would be if you were the President of the United States, and you could, let's say, by executive order, screw Congress, you could, by executive order, skirt Congress and pass any edict that would be social work related or anything like social justice related. What would it be?
Yes. Well, I love this question, Marty. You're talking to a policy junkie, so that's a really hard one. But I will pick one, because there could be so many that I could pick. But if I had to pick one, it would definitely be universal health care and sort of a Medicare for all. Policy so that literally, you know, every American would have health care. That would be my one pick.
And interesting, you know, and I agree. I really do. And there is a downside. Mm-hmm. I'll just throw out one. The millions of, right now, 440,000 people die every year because of medical errors. 440,000. In the hospitals alone. And if we cover everybody for free, and most the ones who are currently not covered who would be covered are going to pay very little in the system. So we already have a system that's overwhelmed. It's going to be even more overwhelmed. And is there not a philosophical and or justice issue regarding the fact that people who have been paying into the system for a million years may die, are more likely to die, because we're covering everybody, including people who may have come here in violation of our laws illegally? I am in favor of single payer. I am. Mm-hmm. But there really is a responsible other side in my mind, even to that. Does it make any sense?
It does. It does. I think you have to be careful. So in other words, I think you have to be so thoughtful when, yep, you design any program like this. But I would just point to the examples around the world where they have single payer systems where they have figured it out. Really smart people have found a way to figure it out. And the outcomes that they have as a result in terms of the health of their citizens is so much better than what we see here in the U.S.
Yeah, and there's always a problem of generalizing for where our population is so different, mm-hmm, from that in Canada. But see, these conversations, I'm trying to role model this. Mm-hmm. These are the conversations where the true best cases are made from a variety of perspectives, lead to, in my judgment, better educated people, whether undergraduates or social work or lawyers or whatever. But I worry that we've moved to a university system where there is a truncation of the very thing that they say they used to treasure, which is not censorship of responsibly held ideas. We can, anyway. So let's just turn with last question, which is, two more. I can't help it. I have a lot of experience with education and planning, mm-hmm, education and accreditation and all the rest of it and certifications.
Yeah.
And it used to be a bachelor's degree was the standard degree for social workers. But as in many fields, for a variety of reasons which are beyond the scope of this discussion, it's been ratcheted up. So now, in social workers and many other fields, a master's is pretty much standard. Mm-hmm. Do you have an opinion about what really were the causes of that increase, and do you believe it's net a good thing to require a master's rather than a bachelor's degree?
Yes. So that, I will say this is a very hotly debated issue. So
yep.
I'll tell you what my opinion is, but
great,
it certainly is debated in my field whether the increasing professionalization of social work is a good thing or a bad thing. I will argue that it's a good thing. For two reasons. One, you know, when you professionalize, you have things like codes of ethics. So we have a code of ethics that's from the National Association of Social Workers, and it basically makes sure that we don't cause harm to the people that we serve, and there's a way to actually make you not practice anymore if you're found to be causing harm. So there's kind of mechanisms in place for things like that. But also, what happens at the master's level is that you get advanced training. You know, at the bachelor's level, it's a very generalist program of gaining skills and knowledge. And when you get your master's degree, you really specialize and get this high-level advanced training, which is a good thing in my view.
Okay, and again, in the spirit of this kind of what I think is thoughtful, intelligent counter, mm-hmm, a code of ethics could very easily be taught at the undergraduate level. It doesn't require a master's degree, and the cost and time and opportunity cost, mm-hmm, of that the person could be working to help the vulnerable, etc. And in terms of advanced versus generic, mm-hmm, that's the problem with the undergraduate training, because professors, by definition, tend to be abstract, theoretical, big picture. If they were taught instead by master social workers at the undergraduate level and taught the advanced practitioner skills, so that the problem is not if you give somebody a general education, you don't solve it by extending it and making it more expensive. You do it by reinventing the people who are teaching the program. What's your reaction? I want to give you the last word.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a really good point. You know, I haven't thought too much about that, to be honest. There are really smart people in my field who think through the best way to deliver social work education. But, you know, you might have an interesting idea there. I'll have to think more about that.
For what it's worth, if I'm running a social work program at the bachelor's level, it's going to be critical incident-based. People who go into social work are not like computer science-type people in general. They tend to learn best from concrete examples.
Mm-hmm.
So my whole curriculum would be based on a series of critical incidents, starting with very easy and getting even more difficult. Critical incidents in the life of a social worker, and as you say, throughout the lifespan, everything from infant abuse to elder abuse and everything in between, and court system and hospitals and everything else, no question.
Yeah.
And they would be in groups. So they're all in active learning. There's no minimum lecture, and they're grappling. You're getting mini lectures that I might give so they get a good bit of critical content and bits of reading, but that they would in small groups grapple with how they would deal with these small things. And I would use computers to create visual immersive simulations as technology advances, even in 3D. And I would bet anything that my students with a bachelor's degree would end up being better, more effective social workers, affecting more, to use your term, social justice, than with yet another series of lectures from academic Dr. Hassenpfeffer types. What's your reaction?
I love it. I love it. I think you should come over to social work education and give us some ideas. You know, what I think what comes up for me is that what I love most about social work, which is the incredible broadness of the field, and there's so many things we do, actually makes it a little bit of a challenge when we go to educate students, because there's so many things that we want to teach them. You know, when you talked about, you know, from children to adults and criminal justice, there's so many you know, things that they need to learn. So it's sort of like, oh my gosh, how do we really pack all of this in?
That term is called the tyranny of content, and it results in presenting too many abstract models. If your major, let's say your major is roughly 1 year worth of courses, in other words, you know, 13, you know, eight or ten courses or 12 courses, if each one consisted of a dozen simulated examples, where each class session was, you tore apart one really good practical example, that would give the kids a dozen times 12, that's 144 of these examples, that, you know, that they would have really torn apart, read about, discussed, etc. I dare say that's more than enough content, and more and better content, and more better equipping them to go out and be good social workers than if you really look at the syllabi for most social work courses. They are filled with lots of dense textbooks that have very little generalization to what does it really take to be a social worker in the real world. You buy that?
Well, I would probably disagree with you a little bit. I do agree that there's a lot of knowledge that they get through readings and through the research articles and books that we read. But the hallmark of social work education, on the other hand, is that they have, you know, like my students do a 440-hour practicum their senior year, where they're out in an organization working under the supervision of a social worker. So really, they're out, you know, learning. So they're in the classroom learning, but then they go out into the field. So there's all of this field learning that's happening that kind of helps bring the two together. So I think it usually works pretty well, actually.
Okay. I will give you the last word, although I still would say starting from the first year, I would have them be doing simulations. Mm-hmm. Not so much in the field. You know, if you watch per hour what goes on even in practicums, there's a lot of time that isn't on point. They're waiting. They're doing something that is – they're hanging around with administrative stuff. Their boss – what the simulation – I teach in the medical school at UCSF, and the most potent thing we do is we have live simulated patients, actors, who come in and they're really well trained, they're excellent, and we do patient interviews, patient exams, etc. That is 100% concentrated time on that which doctors need to know, and I would like to see more of that in social work.
I think that's a great idea.
There you go. Anyway, I always like to end on a personal note, like we start with our doggies in the beginning. What is next for Jessica Ritter, the human being, as a professional or personally, whatever you want? Because I'm a career and personal coach, and I will take any little nick of an opening to see if I can be of help to you. So tell me what are you grappling with?
Well, I'm actually embarking on a very big career change, which is interesting because I've been teaching social work, you know, to undergraduate students for 12 years, and it's been the love of my life to do it. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed it. But I just got promoted to become an associate dean at my university of the social sciences. So it's going to be this whole new foray into administration and how do I support faculty doing what they do. So I'm really excited about it. It's going to be a good new challenge for me, I think.
You use the term support new faculty, so I want to try to just drill down a little bit there.
Mm-hmm.
What's one question that you, let's pretend it's not true, but that I knew everything there is to know in the world about supporting faculty. By the way, I was actually on a National Board of Faculty Development. So let's pretend I knew everything there was in the world to, quote, support faculty. Mm-hmm. What would be the one question you'd want to ask me?
So I'm sorry, say that again. I'm not sure.
What would be the one question? You say you care a lot about what you, when I was listening to you carefully as you described your new job as associate dean, you said you want to know you really want to do a good job of supporting faculty.
Mm-hmm.
What is the one question you'd want to ask me that might help you to get off to a great start supporting faculty?
Yes. Well, I'll be in a supervisory position, which I haven't done this in a lot of time, so I guess I would ask you what would be your experience in supervising people in an effective way where you help them really reach what they want to be doing. You know, what are some tips that you might have for that?
Yes, especially in the academic world, it is extremely important to give them as much power as possible. You're not going to do this with control. You're going to do this with facilitation, and you're perfectly equipped to do that. And so, you know, how many people will you be supervising officially?
About 32 people.
As crazy as it sounds, I would have an individual meeting with each one of them. And I would let them know in advance that the goal is to hear from them what is the one thing that they want to do more of, that they that to build on a strength, and what's an area of weakness that they would like. They call them areas for growth. You know, what's a weakness that they'd like to work on? And they come in, and your job is to listen, ask facilitating questions. If possible, you have a certain budget, so make some resource available if they're trying to create some cool new course, or they realize that they're really not good with X kind of student or whatever. You're there, you're going to meet individually with them. You're going to serve them coffee. You're not going to get somebody to make the coffee. You're going to make the coffee. It's a trick I learned from college presidents. They want to feel less hierarchical. So when somebody comes in their office, they go and they say, "Can I make you coffee, tea, cold drinks, whatever they're called?" And they themselves, not their admin, get the coffee, get the whatever, and sit down and say, "It's a pleasure to meet you. You admit you're a little nervous starting out. You say it's my first administrative job. Mm-hmm. I really want to do a good job." So you're expressing a bit of vulnerability, but not being a basket case, and then saying, "I'm here to serve." Uh-huh. Is there something that you're excited about you're doing that you would like me to know about, and maybe I can be of some support? Is there an area for growth that you would like me to support? I'm here to listen. You do that with each 32 people, you are launching your new administrative career in a way that is not only powerful for all of them, but would build on your social work background. Does that make sense?
It really does. I appreciate that very much. Thank you, Marty.
Well, you're very welcome, and I thank you for being an excellent guest here on Work with Marty Nemko. Her book, 101 Careers in Social Work, now in its second edition. She is the senior author, Jessica Ritter. Thanks very much for giving me part of your Sunday.
Thank you, Marty.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Yeah, she was great. It was fun. Okay, now I want to turn to you, dear listeners. Before I even wait another moment, I'm going to give out the phone number. Oh, I see people calling already. Too bad, maybe they wanted to ask her a question. I'd already kept her 45 minutes and had so much we wanted to cover. Let's let that caller come on the line. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. Sorry I said goodbye to Jessica. I suspect you wanted to ask her a question.
No.
Okay.
I wanted to do a workover. Thank you for asking.
Oh, delightful. Oh, I'm so glad. Oh, good. Tell me. I was feeling remiss. So
no.
Please. Oh, good. Tell me about your situation. I'll do my best to help.
Okay. It's actually for my husband. Mm-hmm. He's sleeping because he worked a graveyard last night.
Oh, boy.
And he's a person who's really... I'd like to just describe him and the problem that he has.
Great.
So he's a very kind, open-hearted, artistic, empathetic person in his 60s.
Mm-hmm.
He has a great sense of humor. He's really non-judgmental. He's been working as a caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
He's got his CNA and HHA, and then it lapsed because he was working so many hours. And he's really playful. So he has all these characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
He loves children, and he loves animals, and they love him.
Mm-hmm.
What he's not is any kind of a disciplinarian.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a supervisor or a boss.
Yeah.
He's not a medical technician.
Yeah.
He's not up for more education at his age.
Yes.
And he's not a child molester.
Right.
So his problem is he'd like to switch over to a job where he's working with children because he gets so much pleasure out of it and because he's so good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And they always open up to him. They'll think this guy is weird at first, and they'll sort of treat him like, who is this person who thinks he can be on my level?
Mm-hmm.
But they always wind up opening up.
He sounds absolutely lovely.
I can trust this guy.
So what I would do, you know, because we live in an era, you know, frankly, of ever more government certifications required, they're going to want to see these certifications, but I at his age, he doesn't want to go back to school. So I would, near where you live, I'd find the names of good quality childcare places, and not university affiliated or government affiliated, because they're going to be demand absolute, but privately run, because they're going to be less subject to having to absolutely have these credentials. So little private childcare, preschools, whatever. And I would start by saying, I would like to make money, but I realize I'm a guy, and we live in a world where guys are seen as child molesters, you know, potential child molesters. Would you allow me to volunteer here a bit so you can kind of try me out? I love kids. I know kids love me. And you might even have somebody call on his behalf so that he's not touting himself, because anybody can tout themselves. But if somebody else, probably better not you, but even could be you, saying, you know, even if you said what you just said, I think that somebody's going to let him volunteer, and then they would see maybe in the first 20 minutes. You know, you can often tell that gift that you just described that he has, I would imagine, it would be visible in the first 2 minutes.
Probably. I was wondering if there was any way he could do medical-type caregiving for either a chronically ill or even a terminally ill child, and that's what I was wondering, whether there
clever
was a
idea.
Way to combine training that he's had
definitely.
And experiences he's had, but I didn't know how to approach pediatricians or oncologists or where there might be a place where somebody would appreciate. He also, because he's strong, he can lift, and so he might be able to work with somebody where a female caregiver could not do those things for a child, and he's not afraid of all of the bodily fluids that come with being really ill.
Wow, great.
He's not somebody who wants to, he's not allowed to do any kind of medical dosing or, you know, medication dosing, or, you know, he can't work with IVs and things like that, but he could be a companion and a caregiver for someone who's ill.
Two things. First of all, I'd like you, when we get off the air, you'll stay on the line and give your phone number to Joanne, who will take your number in case somebody calls in and they have that need.
That's I'm what sure. I was hoping. Thank you.
Oh, yeah,
so
that's
much
easy,
for
and that's great. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And also, what comes to mind are, this, you know, maybe it's just a recency effect from having a social worker on the show, but the social worker is a children's hospital. Or
uh-huh.
at Children's Hospital of Oakland or at UCSF, they might know who there might be a referral list for people who are would be caretakers for children with severe illness.
Uh-huh.
And I might also look at just Google. What city do you live in?
We live in Marin, in, let's say, San Rafael.
Okay, great. So I probably would simply either Google pediatric oncology, and San Rafael or Marin or whatever, and I would probably I know what I would. You know, I don't know if he'd be willing to do this. Do you have a smartphone or a webcam or any kind
uh-huh.
of a camcorder? Does he have an opportunity to interact with children and demonstrate what he does and how he plays with them or whatever?
We could try to find somebody who would be willing to
make
do
a little video of him interacting with a special needs child.
Mm-hmm.
Because a picture's worth a thousand words, and I think if you send that with a note to those pediatric oncologists and to the social workers at, and even like if you live in San Rafael, you know, maybe you just look at Marin General Hospital and see what they've got there and talk to the social workers associated with that.
Mm-hmm.
I can't help, and maybe even putting an ad on Craigslist. I mean, their parents are desperate. I would think that to having a nurturing people, a person, you know, we're less likely to trust a 30-year-old man, but a man in his 60s who clearly gives off the vibes of being kind. I would, if I'm that parent, I'd be desperate to have a person like your husband.
Well, that's the thing, and I put up an ad at one point, and the problem is, and I don't blame these parents at all for being afraid.
Yeah, no,
I really
no,
don't.
No. Well,
however,
the media portray every sitcom and every drama, you know, on Lifetime TV shows some very kindly looking guy, and oh, then he's molesting a woman or a child. I know.
Yeah, it's just plain. It's sad because it's plain prejudice.
It is prejudice.
Someone
it's
who's
the,
a female engineer. I don't see any difference.
It's the only kind of prejudice that's allowed these days.
I know.
Yep,
and
it's
I really
not
don't
only
blame
encouraged.
Parents. It's their most precious person in the world, and I understand that.
All right.
However, these kids do need help.
Yep. Okay. Now. We're gonna say goodbye for being on the air, but stay on the line and give Joanne your phone number. And your husband sounds like a doll.
I caught him. He's mine.
That's sweet. It's very sweet. Well, you sound like you're pretty sweet too. Thanks a lot for calling.
Thank
work with Marty.
You.
Okay, you're very welcome. Okay, let's go back to the phones. Welcome. No, I need a moment. Okay, so let me take just a moment to tell you something I just learned about. There's this robot called Pepper. And it's the first robot that has emotions. And it's being used now in Belgium as a receptionist in hospitals. It can see, it speaks 20 languages. It can see your, it can it's got face recognition, which can see if you're happy, sad, scared, worried, or whatever, and respond appropriately. And here's the punchline. Wired magazine just reported that Pepper is now coming to America, and it's being programmed to understand American kind of subtle cues about how they talk and react. This is the merely the latest, depending upon your bias, it's either the latest boon or the latest stab in the heart to workers. You know, all of us feel humanly like every human being deserves a living wage, $15 an hour plus benefits, even if they're not the most reliable, even if they're not the smartest. Every human being is who's willing to work at least reasonably well. But the problem is when the cost, $15 an hour plus benefits, adds up to $30 an hour when you add Obamacare in and workers' comp and paid family leave, etc. And so I'm seeing again and again and again the robots who are always reliable. They never take a sick day. They're never rude. They're not racist, right, unlike some workers could be, or sexist or homophobic or anything else. And they speak 20 languages. They show up on time every day. They don't sue for wrongful termination. They are equipped with all the best information that can be given. And, of course, there's a human being there if the robot can't answer the question or there's a round. But instead of having 15 people doing the work, they may have one to handle the work that the robot can't do. And believe me that the hospitals are not the only example. Hilton is now trying a virtual concierge. Because concierges can be very often they're bought off by restaurants and theaters or whatever, and they've got Hilton's trying a robotic concierge. Crown Plaza is doing room service with a robot. You really want to see if you're in a romantic tryst with somebody? Do you really? And you're ordering the champagne to come up to your room. Do you really need to see Sean? Here is your champagne. No, you'd probably rather see the robot. And so Crown Plaza is doing that. Lowe's and Osh are having virtual sales clerks that roaming around the sales floor. And there to tell you where an item is and to escort you there. Or if you've got a part, like a screw, you simply put the screw in the little door that opens, and it tells you exactly what the screw is and where it is and whatever. Target is doing the same thing. Nestle is experimenting with automated baristas. Burger Flippers, Carl's Jr. and Hardee's now are using automatic burger makers. And so I've been reading a lot about this more and more over the last 2 years. There is no question that there is a tension, certainly, between wanting to treat human beings humanely and also the increased cost of hiring relative to these robots. So the biggest problem I believe society faces is not terrorism, not cyber terrorism. It is the end of enough jobs for the masses. There'll always be enough jobs for the few cyber geniuses that require the 50 people to create a computer game or some software or a medical device or whatever. But what about the 90% of us that aren't going to be doing that? It is the problem of our millennium. All our lines are lighted up. I have almost no time. I only have time for the quickest of questions. Please pick up the phone. Let's go to the phones. What is your quick question? You only have about 10 or 15 seconds to ask the question.
My question is new paths to accreditation for either the American Bar Association or local states that would bypass or work separately from the standard law school program.
Excellent. I have a quick answer. You don't need to go to law school to be a lawyer. You do have to pass the bar, but you can mentor for 7 years with a licensed attorney or a judge, and that can be helpful. I do think accreditation ends up being self-protective, so I think you're absolutely right. I think the answer to real accreditation is consumer empowerment. There's a reason why Amazon reviews and Wikipedia reviews of things are so powerful, because it's crowdsourcing. It's more valid, even if the people are not credentialed. that crowdsourcing is often a more valid way to judge somebody than what is often a self-protective organization. So I agree with your call. It's a nice little unconventional way to end the show. And that is the end of the show, so I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers, I promise. And what is it really like to be a cryptographer, the person who encodes and decodes things and creates computer security and etc.? I will talk with Whitfield Diffie. He is the newest winner of the $1 Million Turing Award, the so-called Nerd Nobel for computing. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.